A podcast with Ileana Kadushin and James Harrell. Come travel with us on an episode from the road, a new series on the Know I Know podcast. First stop, Jewel of the Blue Ridge in Marshall, North Carolina, where our host, Chuck Blevin, took James and I on a tour of his spectacular property. Over his lifetime, Chuck has been an engineer. He studied geophysics, a businessman, inventor, entrepreneur, author, and lecturer. He has 40 years experience traveling and drinking wines. He's been a guest lecturer at various colleges and universities in 68 countries, and he speaks four languages. In addition to being the quintessential resource on muscadine grapes and growing them, he's presented two TED Talks on viticulture, is the author of two books on wine etiquette and entertaining, a guest lecturer on wine aboard several cruise lines. He trains judges for North Carolina wine competitions, and he makes grape wines, country wines, mead, cider, beer, grappa, raises Scottish Highland cows and chickens, and operates an RV campground. And he enjoys his ham radio and so much more. Are you ready? Here we go.
So let's do a farm tour.
Yes.
So we're standing in practically geographically in the middle of Madison County. You can actually see the Smoky Mountains, that farthest gray ridge way back over there. That's actually Tennessee, because we're right around there, the Tennessee border. Madison County borders on Tennessee. And so that's the Smokies. And all the way back down this direction, you see the other way. Asheville is over that way,
south,
just in front of that big mountain over there. So you can literally see here 50 miles in each direction.
So you got the Smokies, and you got the Blue Mountains.
Blue Ridge.
Blue Ridge.
Yep. So, I have a trivia question for you, City Slickers.
Okay.
See, I can call you to get away with that. Right, Kenny? Kenny, can I call you that?
Just the more fun term is Cityots. That's what the people...
Cityots! Oh, that's even better.
Yeah. That's upstate.
So, trivia question for you. Why are the Blue Ridge Mountains?
Sediment.
Granite.
Granite.
Why are they blue? We just saw this.
Okay.
Is it volcanic formation?
No, it has nothing to do with rock.
Okay.
So when you look up, why is it that you don't see black?
So we're doing water and light refraction, and so I carry on or just stop?
Oh, you can stop. Okay. So the reason when you look up you don't see black is because there's oxygen here. And it just so happens that sunlight has this effect on oxygen that it causes the oxygen molecule to vibrate at a frequency that's blue. So once you get up above it, you look up, it's black. But down is here, because the sunshine's doing it, it's blue. It's a very similar thing that happens to the Blue Ridge Mountains here. In the daytime, all of these forests here actually take in carbon dioxide and exhale oxygen. But most people don't know that at nighttime, the trees take in oxygen and exhale carbon dioxide. But there's a net gain during the day, just the way it works. But all of these things, in addition to exuding oxygen and carbon dioxide, they also give off organic vapors. And the organic vapors here in this particular forest is primarily a family of organic compounds called terpenes. The terpenes is like, you know, alcohol is a family. There's all kinds of different alcohols. There's ethanol, methanol, and so forth and so on. Okay. Ascorbic acid. There's all kinds of alcohols. So in the terpene family, it just so happens that 80% of the vapors that are given off by this particular forest are one specific one called isoprene. And isoprene makes up 80% of it, and it has a similar characteristic as the oxygen does, that it causes the molecule to vibrate, and the frequency is this bluish gray.
Wow.
So that's why the Blue Ridge Mountains are blue.
All right.
So you couldn't live another day without knowing that piece of crap,
I could not.
Right?
Now I can keep living.
I've got more. I had to get rid of, delete something in my head to stuff that in there.
Okay. So I'm full of crap. See, my senior year in high school, we had a reading project. My junior was I read the complete works of Edgar Allan Poe and Shakespeare. But my senior project was reading the Encyclopedia Britannica, which I did. A lot of crap stayed up there. Anyway, so
you, like James, have a lot of
useless
information.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Gazillions of pieces of worthless information.
That you plague your wife with, right?
Yes. Well, no, she's a word person. We have a lot of fun with it. She's sort of similar to me in that way. Okay,
oh, good.
So let me talk to you about Madison County. So Madison County is geographically the largest of 100 counties we have in North Carolina. It's also, I think, like the second least populated. There's only like 20,000 people in the whole county, okay. You know. Marshall down here is a county seat with 842 people now that Gene and I are here. And this used to be the center of burley tobacco. There was more burley tobacco grown in the 50s and 60s and 70s here than any place on earth. Okay. So you'll see a lot of these barns. I mean, imagine going back to the 50s where there's only like 5,000 people here. There are still standing over 25,000 tobacco barns. Okay. This one is about 90 years old now. So tobacco was a big deal. And so everything here historically revolves around tobacco, basically. And moonshine. We were one of the biggest producers of moonshine.
Two great tastes that taste great together, right?
Yeah, and then we had, sort of, and then we had the last great big famous moonshiner actually killed himself just recently. His name was Pop Rosette. He got caught running brews over in Tennessee, and they put him in jail. He said he wasn't going to put up with him anymore, so he wasn't going back to prison, so he killed himself. Anyway, he was the last great famous one. But anyway, there's still a lot of moonshine produced here. But
so it makes sense we sat under a full moon last night. It's the land of moonshine.
Yeah. So we've got these wonderful mountains here. And when you come into the county, the sign says, "Welcome to Madison County. Jewel of the Blue Ridge." Son of a gun, isn't that the name of our vineyard? Yes. Well, I wonder how that came about. Well, when Gene and I first bought this property 14 years ago, we were thinking about what are we going to call our farm, our vineyard? What are we going to call it? So we looked at the Blue Ridge, something or other, and went to the registration, Secretary of State. That name's taken. Okay, so talk about the Blue Moon, something, something. That name is taken. We went through about, I don't know, 10 names maybe. And just on a whim, I said, you know, here we are, the Jewel of the Blue Ridge. Why don't we just name it that? And so I looked in and searched it, and it wasn't taken. Nobody had registered the name. So a friend of mine, Steve Garrett, was county manager at that time. So I called, and I registered the name. Right? So I called up Steve Garrett, and I said, "Steve, you got my permission to use our name on your signs coming into the county."
Sometimes.
So what are you talking about? I said, "Well, Jewel of the Blue Ridge." I said, "I just trademarked the name." "You know what?" I said, "He said, this stupid people didn't do this years ago." I said, "No, they didn't do it. So now we got it, but I give you permission to use my name on your sign." So he laughed about it. And he checked it out and he called me back. He said, "You're right. They never trademarked." Okay. So So I keep threatening to go out to all the signs coming in the county and put vineyard under that. Jill the Blue Ridge Vineyard.
I love it. Dear listeners of the Know I Know podcast, we are standing on this beautiful land of Jewel of the Blue Ridge. So we're here with Chuck and touring the land. So you're getting to go along the tour with us.
Okay, so now that you understand that this is sort of tobacco central and moonshine central and all that kind of stuff for years and years, it's evolved today. When we first came here, some of the last allotment checks were made, if you know what allotment checks were, you're not being from this area. So the government decided that having tobacco is not healthy for you. So they put this program together where they started discouraging the growth of tobacco. And the way they did that was through allotment checks. So if you had, say, 10 acres of tobacco, the government come in and say, "Okay, we're going to pay you for one of those acres. Whatever you would have made, here's the money for that acre. You can only grow 9 this year." The next year they come back and say, "Okay, we're going to grow for 2, so you can grow 8. And the next year will be, "We're going to pay you for 3, or 7, until it's all gone. Okay, now the idea was that this money that these farmers were taking for not growing tobacco would be applied to growing pecans, grapes, apples, or something else. And unfortunately, 99% of them just spent it. Bought new cars, new tractors, and all this kind of stuff. And it never went anywhere. Okay, so now that the last allotment checks were, we had this whole area go into Big Depression. Okay, because now all the money was gone. So the newer generation coming up now is waiting for their parents to die, because the new guys, average age of a farmer here, Madison County, we got about 1,500 of them left, is about 59 years old now. And they're not going to start raising Christmas trees or grapes or something. It's going to take 6, 7, 8 years to mature where they can start getting money, because they've been, for their generations, planting in the spring, harvesting in the fall, and getting the money. Okay? So anything takes more than 1 year than I understood. But the young kids, they can't wait till mom and dad die, because because they want to do something else. Right? And we're getting them. We've got a number of vineyards planted now with these special grapes just because of that. Right?
How big is the whole property that you have, Chuck?
10 over there, 16 over here.
Okay.
26 acres.
How much of it is used for the grapes?
1 acre.
Okay.
And it's because there's such huge production that comes out of these vines. Most grapevines that you see, there's 15,000 varieties in the world. We grow the only cold hardy muscadines, the scuppernongs, in the world here. I found the wild muscadines growing here. It took me 3 years of my life to figure out how to propagate them. And then we planted a vineyard with them. And then I spent another 5-6 years cheating to breed the very first ever cold hardy scuppernong. So that's what we do here, okay? But when you talk about the 15,000 varieties of regular grapes, and you talk about there's only 300 varieties of muscadines and scuppernongs, but they're different in so many ways you can't imagine. They're not the same. You don't propagate them the same. You don't plant them the same. You don't prune them the same. You don't train them the same. You don't. It's just nothing the same.
Muscadine, you said,
muscadine,
right?
Yes. Muscadine. And scuppernongs. Muscadine is a family. Typically, we call the red ones the muscadine muscadine, and the white one we call the scuppernong muscadine. Who knew? But the production rate on them is just outlandish, because a normal vineyard will be happy if they get about 3 to 3.5 tons of grapes per acre, using about 600 vines. We plant 200 to the acre, and we'll get easily 10 to 12 and sometimes 16 tons an acre.
Wow.
So the production capacity on them is just outrageous. That's why we're trying to get farmers here to grow these grapes. But like I said, most of them are not interested in growing something that's going to take 6 years to get grapes.
And then now you sell the muscadine to
we have
other
all
winemakers?
No, yes and no. We have this property you see here, the classroom up there. And this is classically called a teaching vineyard. Okay, because that's what I do.
Teaching vineyard.
Is I go up here, for example, I'll do a pruning class. And I'll spend about an hour in a classroom going over the nomenclature, because there's a whole bunch of special terminologies used in the viticulture industry that you don't hear anyplace else. So I found it's best to go over the terminology stuff there rather than get out in the vineyard and have so many interruptions, people asking very simple questions because they don't understand a term. So we get that out of the way. Then we walk across here and put the pruning shears in their hands and show them how to do it with hands on. And I tend to do that. I'm putting my schedule together for 2022 now. And I'll have a propagation class, I have a planting class, I'll have a training class, I'll also have a trellising class showing people how to do this, and again, always with an hour on the terminology, and bring them over here and actually do it. Get the wires in their hand, get the things, dig the holes, everything you have to do is hands-on. So
well,
it's a teaching thing.
Do you hear that, the wannabe grape growers of America?
So what we do then is we have income for a farm. It comes from the classes I teach. Then we sell the vines that you'll see in our Wallapini in a minute. We also have a pick-your-own arrangement. And then I have a lot of my winemaking friends that come over here and do a one-for-one deal where they pick, say, 50 pounds of my grapes. They give me half. They take half without paying. So they can get the grapes for no cost. It's a little bit of labor to pick them. It helps me and Jeannie with our harvesting because we get half of what they pick. So they love it, we love it, everybody's winning.
And you guys get to keep your pink fuzzy slippers on and your bonbons on.
Well,
right?
Almost, but I said we don't have pink fuzzy and bonbons, trust me.
Chuck is not wearing slippers, Chuck is wearing boots.
I still have to come out here and give them the picking buckets, have to show them how. I mean, seriously, we had two ladies here just last week. In fact, day before you came was our last harvest day. So we had two ladies over here who were doing the last pick your own. I had to show them how to pick grapes. Now, that sounds very simple, like, well, you just grab the grape and pull it. No, that's not the way you do it. The structure I'm getting ready to show you is called a Wallapini, W-A-L-A-P-I-N-I. It's an Incan word from Bolivia. It means earth house. It resulted from some research that was done by, I think it was World Health Organization and the United Nations, because the people, the indigenous people of Bolivia, were suffering from diseases that were being that was caused by a lack of specific nutrients, because at 8,500 feet average elevation in Bolivia,
you can't grow much. So they weren't getting any leafy vegetables and stuff like that to help with the diet. So they were having health problems. So they put together this project to figure out how to help him. And what they came up with is they went down there in Bolivia and dug down in the ground about 10 feet. And they put sticks across the top of the hole. They built some shelves inside using rammed earth. And they covered this with plastic. It's like a 10 mil thin plastic. And using that, they were able to start growing vegetables year-round. And that helped the health thing and solved the problem. So where you're standing right now, 10 feet down, the temperature is 55 degrees Fahrenheit year-round. Okay, unless you're standing on a volcano. But here, it's 55 degrees. Even though the temperature up here, right here where we're standing, in the wintertime, typically gets to be 5 degrees, 6 degrees Fahrenheit in the wintertime, inside the Wallapini, it never gets below 40 degrees.
Because you have geothermal.
Yeah, it's all Mother Earth doing the work for us. There's no electricity in here. There's no kerosene, propane, none of that. I've got water in here, but that's the water of my plant. If you look here and lean over, you'll be able to see through underneath this roof.
Yep.
Okay. So the only thing that's protecting the inside from the outside is that little thin layer of plastic on the bottom in there. You'll see that on the roof when we go inside. This top section here is a special type of material. It's like an acrylic plastic, but it's not really acrylic. It's a special formulation that was made for greenhouses down in Texas. And it has two unique characteristics that we require. What I've learned through my research here on my time and my dime is that you can't propagate muscadines and scuppernongs in full sunlight. Even when I had a small greenhouse before I built this, I had to put a screen over top of the greenhouse to cut the sunshine down about 50%. So it turns out that this material only allows 52% of the sunshine through, which is nice. And it also blocks out the blue rays, because there's infrared, visible, and ultraviolet. But the blue rays actually cause stunting of plants. So you don't trying to propagate something, you don't want it being stunted in order to grow. So this blocks out the blue rays, which is another plus. But it's also just a mechanical protection from hail and animals running across. I mean, I can walk across it, but it's just a mechanical protection for the thin layer of plastic, because I didn't do it the way they did in Bolivia, where it's high enough where they don't do that. Arches and all. Mm-hmm. So anyway, so what I did here is I built this in such a way I have an anteroom. And the anteroom allows me to do this. In the wintertime, I can open this up,
get in here,
step inside, lock the door, then open this door and go inside, do my work, come back out, lock this door, open this one, come out, lock it back from the outside. So this keeps the cold air from winter coming in. But because it's summertime right now, I can leave open temporarily so you can go inside.
And zip in.
Yep. The fog gets your glasses typically, but probably not.
Rainforest.
Just like that. That's the whole idea.
I'm sleeping here tonight.
Yeah, Chuck, we're going to sleep in here tonight.
I guess you will. You can share it with the blue gate, the skinks.
Skinks? Is that a snake?
Yeah, so the temperature today in here is 70 degrees already. And before the end of the day, it'll be up to about 70 or 80 degrees. So what you're looking at here is 10 feet on the inside, 40 feet long inside. I've got vents on each side that are open in the summertime. What you think you see here is irrigation. It's really not. These are foggers, because we found out that last year I killed 850 plants. August day, got too hot, above 60, or above 95 degrees, the plants die. So I had to do some cooling things. So this drops the temperature in here about 8 degrees. I can get about 3 or 4 degrees by opening those vents. I can get another couple degrees by opening the door. But that still wasn't enough. So in August this year, I kept every day coming in watching that temperature. And temperature kept creeping up closer to 95. I finally had to put tarps over the outside. Because even though this is very, very efficient for warming in the winter, it's not for crap at cooling in the summer. So it needs a lot of help. So these plants that you see here have been propagated this summer. And these are the ones that are being propagated now. We take a cutting off the cane out there and stick it in the ground if we put some rooting hormone on it. And you'll see, well, it's better to show you down here, I guess, some of these. You see that some of these are staying nice and dark green, and some of them are not. This one right here will probably die. So when they start yellowing down, that means they didn't take. So this one took, looks like this one right here took. That means they formed the callus on the form of the stem. And if you can hold the temperature in the daytime about 80 degrees for like 30 days, it'll form the callus. Then you got to hold it for another 30 days for the roots to start coming out of the callus. And once that happens, we take them out of this special volcanic ash type stuff. It's called the vermiculite. And once we get that, it's like glitter sort of. But anyway, once they form roots in here, then take them out and put them in the dirt pots like those down there. You see how nice and dark green all those plants are because they're in soil now. And here they're just in vermiculite.
So what kind of dirt do you have? Do you have a special mix that you make, or that's the...
Right there.
Okay.
Okay. That ProMix BX, magic on that's called mycorrhizae. You see that down below?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you don't know what mycorrhizae is.
Nope.
It's a fungus. It's about 1/1000th of the diameter of your hair. Okay? And it grows in the soil. So what we do is we intentionally inoculate that bag of stuff with that. I mean, we buy it that way mixed. And that's what we put our plants in. So when people plant these pots, they actually plant it with the dirt. So the soil around it becomes inoculated with this mycorrhizae. The mycorrhizae has a very special symbiotic relationship with grapes. It attaches itself to the roots, and then they communicate. So one day, the mycorrhizae wakes up and says, hey, I need some carbohydrates today. And the grapevine says, okay, take some. And the amount that, because it can't, the fungus can't generate carbohydrates. Okay, so it takes some. And the amount is so small, it's in the picograms. They can barely measure it. Okay, but one day, the grapevine wakes up and says, ooh, I need some selenium or some boron or some other trace element today. Communicates it to the mycorrhizae. And they've used isotopes to measure this mycorrhizae going out as far as 60 feet away from the plant and bringing it along its little conveyor belt back to the grapevine.
Yeah.
And so even in crappy soil, if you've got mycorrhizae in there, it'll bring in the trace elements it needs for the grapevine. It's really amazing stuff.
Do you know about Paul Stamets?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. I've got a couple of his books.
Nice.
And this is, I'm just getting ready to plant some lettuce for the winter. This is called pumpless, filterless hydroponics. You can look in here real quick. The little teeny tiny green things you'll see in there.
Is that right?
Lettuce. See that?
Micro.
That's my lettuce. Okay. And in another day or so, I'll very carefully take those out and stick them in here and fill this up with hydroponic solution. And over the winter, we'll have lettuce that'll grow about this high out of it. And we'll have fresh lettuce through the winter.
Okay. So it's like also your greenhouse out here. So I don't have a ton of wine knowledge. Do the muscadine grapes, what is the varietal of wine that they would end up being?
Called muscadine.
Just called muscadine wine.
Yep.
Okay, there you go. I learned something.
And is this patterned off of another region in the world?
Like, what?
Like how you set everything up.
The vineyard?
Like, you know, every territory has like a different climate and soil.
Oh,
and
yeah, well, hell yes.
Like who did you see?
I looked at, when we first came here, I put in, 14 years ago, I came here. I had done some research on this place and I had found that there were about maybe a dozen to 14 different varieties of regular grapes of the 15,000 that would be considered cold hardy that should grow well here. And so I had arranged a set of test plots here and at half a dozen other farmers' locations around the area. And we were growing all kinds of, you can grow any kind of grapes here, but the trick is you can grow them long enough where they get a high enough concentration of sugar to make good wine. That doesn't happen most of the time. So I was teaching classes in viticulture over here at the extension office and out here at AB Tech Community College. And every time I had a class, it'd be some old codger in the back of the room, bib overalls, straw hat on, snuff running down his chin. I got me some of them there scupperdines going out by my barn. And everything that I had read in literature prior to coming here, because I'd researched the crap out of it, is that muscadines can't grow here. They don't grow above 1,800 feet because it's too cold. They're not cold hardy. All the 300 varieties available in the world are not cold hardy. They grow from Texas to Florida up to eastern Delaware and out to Arkansas, okay? Typically below 1,500, 1,600 feet, okay? you plant them above that, they may or may not live. Most of them don't ultimately. Here in the Piedmont, out east of us, they replace about 5% of their vines every year because they don't. They're not cold hardy. So I said, well, I sure would like to see that. So he gave me his address. And Jeannie and I, on a weekend, we'd get in our four-wheel drive truck, and we'd go up all these creeks and hollers and ridges around here. My God, you wouldn't believe some of the places that we saw. But we'd go up there, and it wouldn't be muscadines because these people here don't know anything about grapes. They'd be, well, they'd be fox grapes. That was most common. They might be Concords. A lot of people here grow Concord grapes, just make some jam and jelly. They might be Niagaras. They might be Catawbas. They make Cahuillas, a couple other native varieties, but they wouldn't be muscadines. So we did this probably, I'm going to say, maybe 25 or 30 times over a couple of years. And one day I was teaching a class over here, and this old guy said, I've got some scupperdines growing out by my fence. And I said, boy, I sure would like to see that. So we jumped in the truck that weekend and went out there, and sure enough, they were there. And I thought, no. So I went to talk to the neighbors. Did these people plant these here some time ago? No, my great-granddad used to tell stories about he and his friend over there get all sick as a dog and have diarrhea from eating all those grapes when they're ripe. And says, no, they've been here since 1812 or some damn thing. I was okay. So they were there. And so I figured, well, I can understand how they could get here, you know, with the animals carrying them just over the centuries, just higher and higher. But only the ones with the cold hardy gene would survive because they'd be planted from seeds. Right? So I took a cutting over here to Ross at the extension office. I say, Ross, do you know we got muscadines growing here in the mountains? No, you're new here. You don't know anything about grapes. And I said, oh, and I laid the vine down with the leaves, which is unique from all the other grapes. Okay. He didn't recognize it because he knows squat about it. I said, okay, fine. I'm always up for learning something new. So I went out and I took pictures of the trunk, took pictures of the tendrils, took pictures of the leaves. And at that time it was September, so there's some green grapes on them. Took pictures of grapes. And I sent them to a couple friends of mine I know grow muscadines for a living. And they come back and they said, Chuck, there's some muscadines. I said, they're growing here at 3,000 feet. Oh, they're not supposed to be there. I said, they're here. So I took the emails I got over to Ross. I said, Ross, look at this. It's not crazy guy Chuck in the mountains. These people you know. It's a muscadine. Well, it's cold here. It's too high. You know, even if they have a growing season where they grow, they won't live long enough to be anything except they'll be bitter and you won't be able to make anything out of it. Okay, so Jeannie and I waited until around the 1st of October when the first frost hits. That's typically when you go harvest out in Wyoming. We went through and picked a couple gallons, brought them home. Jeannie made some muscadine preserves. I made a little bit of juice. Didn't have enough to make wine, but you know, she made a pie or two. And so I took a jar of this preserve over there and said to them, hey, Ross, try this. Give him a cracker. He said, what is it? I said, just try it. So he dipped a cracker in the preserve and tasted. That's good. What is that? I said, this is made from grapes that aren't supposed to be here, but if they were here, they wouldn't live long enough to be ripe enough to be worth anything, be too bitter. And he just looked at me. And that's the instant I knew that there's something unique and very wonderful about these grapes. And so I spent the next 3 years of my life trying to figure out how to propagate them. 3 years just trying to figure out how to propagate them. Not easy. And compared to regular grapes, in the springtime, if you take a dormant cane and just stick it in the ground and water it, like 99% of the time you get another grapevine, just like what you cut it off of. You try that here with muscadines, the success rate is less than 1%. I tried hundreds, less than 1%. So I finally figured it out. And you have to use something called greenwood cuttings. It's a whole different technique to do that. And I've transferred that process into my Lalapini now. So now we have plants for sale. So part of our farm income, in addition to the classes that we teach, is the sale of the plants. You pick your own coming out of the vineyard, and some other things. Jeannie makes our commercial harvest that we take out of here, we put in the freezer, and after the season's over, which is now, they'll schedule us for food processing, and we'll ship them out to a place near Raleigh called Divine Foods. And Divine Foods will turn it into Jeannie's recipe for Jeannie's Muscadine Grape Hull preserves. Not jam, preserves, like strawberry preserves. Wonderful stuff.
Ooh, I gotta try that.
So that's what we do, and we sell it through local stores, and we're out now. But they still haven't given them a processing date. Probably be sometime in February, which means it'll be like May before we get the next batch.
We'll have to come back for it. You are listening to the Know I Know podcast. Here we are at Jewel of the Blue Ridge.
That's right.
So we're walking through the vineyard.
Unfortunately, like I said, last week was the last harvest, so there might be a spare grape here or there that's gotten ripe within this last week, so we'll see if we can find one so you can at least taste them.
It's pretty to see it at this time of year.
Wait till you see it in the first of September, these things are loaded with grapes. I mean, there'll be 100 pounds or more on one vine.
So September's the time where you see it the fullest.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I see. Oh,
here we go.
Look at that.
Let's see. Okay, there's a ripe one. That one's not ripe. See, it's pink.
Yeah.
It's going to be black. Sorry. I'll get another one for you.
We'll share.
James. No, I'll get one for you.
Yeah, pop that thing in your mouth.
Let me get it. Yeah, just swallow the seeds and skins all because good roughage for you.
Here's a couple. What about those?
Not ripe.
All right.
They're red. See them? There's a green one.
We want black.
That one's damaged.
Back to the earth.
They just about dry clean them. I mean, they come in here and...
Dry clean.
There we go.
Oh.
That's what color is supposed to be when they're ripe.
There you go, James.
Black of the berry, the sweet of the juice. Tastes like a Concord.
No way.
No way?
Not even close.
James, that's insulting.
Come on.
Not even close.
Just a little. Come on.
No.
No?
Not even... Look, I trained the wine judges for Western North Carolina. Done it for 12 years.
All right, hold on.
I've tasted Concord wines from all across the country. These are not even close to Concord, so don't go there.
Don't go there. You've insulted Chuck now.
All right. we're gonna take a brief pause here for a second.
Wow.
I know. I started up something pretty bad there. So when I first popped that thing into my mouth, not knowing any of the characteristics of it, it felt like a Concord grape. It didn't look like one. It was a green skin with the spreckles on it. Had a little bit.
Spreckles.
Had a little bitterness to it. But just for everyone's information, I have 15 plus years in fine dining experience.
Ooh, la-di-da.
Yes. And one of my jobs was to sell really expensive bottles of wine to customers. And you have to know what you're talking about.
Well, maybe your palate's off because you haven't been drinking wine for the last 7 years.
It's been 7 years since I've had a glass of wine, but my nose still works, right?
Right.
So I can stick my nose in a glass of wine and I can figure out all the characteristics.
But come on, be real, James. Did you not know when that popped out of your mouth, tastes like a Concord, that Chuck might take issue with that?
And he did, and that was...
And you can't tell this, listeners, but throughout this incredible tour and life lesson with Chuck, the facial expressions, a lot of times when
sideways,
James would say
stuff,
he'd either be kind of poker face and no expression or just a sideways glance at you.
All right, so let's get back to the show.
See, we had Concords in our backyard in Brooklyn, James, but I don't think that tastes like Concord at all.
Well, I just bit the inside of my mouth, so I got what I deserve.
Chuck's mad at you now.
No, I'm not. There's one that's close. Any grape in the world, any fruit in the world, like berries, raspberries, strawberries, that wine can be made as sweet or as dry as the winemaker chooses. Typically, most European wines are dry or off-dry. Typically, some of them are very sweet, but most of them are dry. In the United States, this muscadine family is considered a southern grape because of geographically where it grows, as I explained earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And only in the south, you go in a restaurant, you find the waitress who says, tea, sweet or unsweet. No place else. Okay? So the southern taste is sweet. And so traditionally, the muscadine wines have been made sweet. Unfortunately, most winemakers in the state make it sweet, but they make it with a really crappy component that makes it taste like junk. And we've only got really three or four good winemakers that consistently win competitions.
Mm.
I know who they are.
Tell us, Jeff.
No, it's a mystery.
Now.
It has such a specific flavor, like not just sweet, it's so much.
There's nothing like this in the world. These grapes have a unique flavor, as does the wine. Okay?
Mm.
It's truly a unique grape. Now, I put these seeds out here because what I've learned over the years is that the best winemakers in the world, they pick their grapes when they're perfectly ripe. And all grapes in the world, when perfectly ripe, that seed is a chocolate brown.
Okay.
So these aren't quite ripe. Right? Mm-hmm. See that?
Yep.
So it's one of the things I teach in my class. It was a little bit riper, but it's not still not dark enough, right? Mm-hmm. But that's the way it works. I usually swallow my seeds because it's good roughage.
Yeah.
Skins and the seeds, good roughage.
I'm definitely going to have to buy a Scuppernong wine.
Right.
So if I tell you, you want a really good spicy wine, it's got to be less than $12 retail. Okay? I've been threatened, physically threatened, on cruise ships when I've been lecturing around the world and other places. We're telling you what I'm going to tell you. The average price to put a bottle of wine on the shelf retail is $10, well, maybe 12 now, $12 worldwide. Anything you pay over $12, you're paying for marketing fluff. Okay? $12. So it's incumbent on us as informed consumers of wine, and I'm probably worse than most of them because I'm too picky. I know what a good wine tastes like because I train the wine shops. Okay? I can go over here to the store and give you 5 off-the-shelf bottles of wine for less than $10 that competes with any $60, $70, $80 bottle you get out of California. Okay? So why in the hell would you go and buy $50 of a bottle when I can give you one here for $7.95? Same quality, better balanced.
Yeah.
Okay? I can tell you. Go right now and pick it right off the shelf. And
yeah.
But you can't do that with the Muscadine and Scuppernongs. Because they don't have any good ones on the shelf here.
Gotcha.
That's a good piece of intel. I tend to choose wine based off regions and grapes, you know, that I have familiarity with, that I know, like the Willamette region Oregon, where I tasted something.
It's good for what?
What?
Gamay Noir, Pinot Noirs.
Willamette Valley is the best place for the terroir, the weather, and everything for growing Pinot Noir in the world. They are even better than most places in France. Okay, consistently year in, year out, the Pinot Noir comes out of Willamette Valley is the best in this country. California can do it once every 7 or 8 years, but Willamette Valley, consistently every year. Mm. And keep in mind that it's different between the winemakers. You got some bad winemakers up there, too.
I'm sure.
Okay, but the good ones, oh, wonderful.
I know. Right? I fell in love with a wine from there, yes. And then I was on a search for it for the rest of my life.
It's like that virtually on every country.
Right.
Okay. So if you know the regions of the countries, I teach classes on French wine labels, French wine regions, German wine. I mean, I do all that. I got about 110 lectures I do on cruise ships. Okay? So if you know how to read the wine labels for foreign wines, you'll never get a bad bottle of wine.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. No chance for United States or Australia. There are no quality standards, and nothing on the label tells you what's inside. It's awful. Just awful.
Well, I feel like I earned a few points with him with the Willamette Valley reference.
You know, Sauvignon Blanc? Sauvignon Blanc, the best in the world, comes from New Zealand.
Yeah. I do love a good New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc.
Specifically, the north end of the South Island, called the Marlborough region.
Yes.
Best in the world.
All right. I like that one.
But that's, you know what? There's a lot of lychee characteristics in their Sauvignon Blancs. I found it's too rich for me. But well, it is delicious.
It's good for me.
There's a nice fig for you.
Oh, thank you.
You like figs?
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Let's see if I can find another
especially
one.
Especially ones
this,
like a
this
fresh
one,
pit.
This one just started producing this year. It's called the Chicago Cold Hardy, which is why I got it. And boy, does it produce. Holy crap. Here we go.
Mmm. Wow. That's incredible.
You bite this off. Hold the stem and bite the rest of it off. Throw the stem away.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Oh, so good. So good.
But anyway, it's this was very successful here because it's produced lots. We picked probably 50 or 60 figs off this thing already. As big as it is.
Prolific.
It's really wonderful. Then we served the cake. I served it with carrot wine. Blew them away.
Carrot wine.
Carrot wine. Is that a real thing?
I'm the country wine expert in Western North Carolina. I'm writing a book on it. I've collected over 300 recipes. I can make wine out of oak leaves, out of walnut leaves, out of Bermuda grass. I can make wine out of anything that grows and have. Okay.
Carrot wine. That's dandelion amazing. Dandelion wine, I've heard of.
Okay. Rhubarb wine. Another popular. We have two commercial wineries in this country that produce just dandelion wine. We've got three that produce rhubarb wine. We've got several that produce beet wines. I mean, but we don't know it because the distributors have everything locked up in this country. We can't go to any one of our stores in the state and buy dandelion wine or rhubarb wine or carrot wine.
Yeah, I know dandelion wine from basically just a guy coming and makes.
Yeah, I grew up on that. Yeah. Okay? I grew up on it.
People have to, like, just share their personal recipes.
And the reason I'm writing this book is because our parents or their parents, when they came over, they came over with this know-how and technology that most people, they've forgotten. Like how to make cheese, how to make bacon. I taught the local farmers how to do that, okay? And this country wine thing, hell, the people in England today and Australia today have huge clubs with hundreds of members that make country wines. And they have competitions every year. Who makes the best carrot wine, the best beet wine, the best... I mean, it's serious stuff over there. Our ancestors brought that know-how with them, and we've lost it. In two generations, we've lost it. Okay? Whatever's growing, whatever's outside, make some wine. Hell yes. Okay?
Amen, Chuck. That's why we like talking to people like you and spreading it to the audience.
I've got that book in progress. It's about 90%. That's my winter work, writing.
Yeah.
So I'm working on my third and fourth book now. The third one is on these muscadines and all the details about how we did it and why we did it and all that stuff.
I'll be so happy to introduce people to you so that when the book comes out, they know about you.
Well, it'll be for sale on my website when it comes out.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, you'll let us know and we'll share that knowledge with our community.
I'll put you on my email list.
Good. So appreciate you sharing all your knowledge and your stories.
Well, we love to have people come visit so they can see here. And typically our farm tours are people who never... They've totally lost connection with growing food. You know, I mean, we have people come over and say, oh, how could you eat those cows? You got a name for them. It's like a pet. I said, no. This is a farm. We raise beef for food.
All right.
Hey, Roy. Well, when Gina came here, we had to introduce the locals to a new term. And everybody says, don't say that. We wanted to have viticulture gardening here in viticulture.
No, sorry.
We want to have biodynamic viticulture.
Yeah.
Okay. You know what biodynamics is, right? Rudolf Steiner. So in order to do that, we had to have cows. So we went to great lengths to figure out which cows to have, and the one we selected was ideal and all that stuff. So what we've been trying to do for the last 4 years is to convert all of our growing into 100% biodynamic viticulture and gardening. And so we have a calendar on our... in our kitchen on the back of one of our cabinet doors. And before we go outside in the morning, first thing is open up. It's a day, a leaf day, a root day, or, you know, fruit day, whatever. And that's what we do that day, okay? Every time we ignore that, we get bitten rear end. I mean, it's just awful.
And you don't follow that guide.
Yeah. It's just really a very interesting thing.
Biodynamic viticulture. Yep.
Don't panic. It's biodynamic.
Yeah, that's a good line. Well, you know, look, it got a bad rap many years ago because the local farmers, as soon as you hear bunny, here's the first thing that pops in mind. Dancing around the moon, moonlight, naked.
That's what they think you're doing up here, Chuck?
Oh, yeah.
But if anyone came but to we watched you, the, they'd we get, you're not woo-woo.
We tried. But anyway, It's really paying attention to the moon and paying attention to the positions of the planets and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, when I tell people, and we tried this, okay? Rudolf Steiner had a graduate student. Her name was Maria Thun, German, spelled T-H-U-N. Okay? And her legacy today is the biodynamic calendar, which we buy one every year. Mm. So Maria Thun was one of his graduate students. So after they did their work in Germany, she decided to pick up what she called peasant wisdom from the farmers that are doing talking to when they're solving this other problem for the German government. So she observed some things going on with the farmers that they didn't understand. They knew it worked, but they didn't understand it. For example, the farmers there knew that if you planted your oats like 3 days before the full moon, you'd get like 80% more production than if you planted 3 days after the full moon. They didn't know why. They just knew that was so. And so if you can get 80% more or something, you pay attention. Okay, well, that's it. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Now we plant. Okay. And my grandparents, they lived out in Ohio. They were farmers. And I remember as a kid, dumb kid from West Virginia, I remember as a kid sitting there at the dinner table. And Harry would be talking to Grandpa Harry. We'd be talking to him. Well, Harry, signs say we should start planting them taters tomorrow. And I'm thinking, signs? Oh, okay. Right? So in those days, we had Burma Shave signs.
Yeah.
Burma Shave signs are along the road. You drive out through the country, be four or five Burma Shave signs, right? So I'm out there the next day in the garden working with her. I'm looking. She said, what are you looking for? I said, I'm looking for the signs. She said, what signs? I said, well, you and Grandpa were talking about the signs, said it was time to plant the taters, and I just wanted to see where the sign was. I mean, you stupid kid.
Yeah.
Somebody put up a sign, it's time to plant the potatoes. I you know.
Yeah. Burma Shave. Right.
So, yeah. So she starts laughing. And she said, well, I said, no, that's not the kind of sign we're talking about. She said, it has to do with the moon and the temperature. And sand. Okay, fine. So that was the first time I got unintroduced to the signs, right? So Maria Thun picked up all this stuff from these farmers when they were working in Germany on a special project with the cows. So she decided to test some things out and see why was this. And so what she would do is she'd take a handful of carrot seeds, you know, and she had a garden. And so on the first of the month, say 1st of April. So 1st of April, she'd plant a row. The 2nd of April, plant a second row. The 3rd of April, plant another row. Okay. Mm-hmm. So same soil, same sun, same wind, okay, and same batch of seeds, right? So at the end of the growing season, she'd stand back like this, and she'd look down a rows, and it'd be just like this.
Wow.
Okay. Mm. Perfect sinusoidal arrays. So when she went out and started harvesting, here's what she got. She got carrots that had long tops, tall tops, and short bottoms, root, you know, the carrot. Then she had some that had short top, great big root. She had some that had short top, short root, and some that had a short top, a big top, and a small root. I mean, all from the same batch, same time, everything. And what the hell was there? What was going on? So she did this for 26 years.
Mm.
She did this with peas. She did it with radishes. She did all kinds of stuff. But the carrots was the most telling one. Because once she harvested them, she found out that the best way to get the big tops and get the big bottoms was planted at a certain time when the position of the moon and this and that, okay? And she documented all that. And that became her calendar for planting and so forth.
Wow. Right?
Okay? That's the binary calendar. It was the source of it. But the funny thing was, Jeannie and I have tried this. And so if you plant the carrots on the wrong time, you cut it, the end of the carrot is dry, and the knife is dry. Okay, and you taste it, and it's bitter.
Mm.
And you plant them at the right time, you cut it, there's a little bit of juice on the end of the carrot, a little bit of juice on the knife, and you taste it, and it's sweet. Same carrot seed, same everything. Just the time that you plant it. It's crazy.
I'm telling you, like, some things are genuinely woo-woo, but I don't feel like the moon and the sun and the temperature is woo-woo. I think it's legitimate.
Well, of course it is. You know what does, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's like people have had to survive, you know, since the beginning of time. So it's like you're going to figure things out that make your life
easier. Well, most of these people didn't read. They didn't have internet. Yeah. They didn't have all stuff. They're farmers. Well, yeah. You know, they had to live on what they knew and how they grew stuff. But they didn't. They weren't smart enough to figure out all the positions of all this stuff, but they knew when to plant things at the right time.
But you know, there's a lot of cultures like that. I narrate audiobooks, and I narrated a book about Egypt.
Yep.
And the first, one of the big female Hatshepsut.
Yes.
And I couldn't believe how much in Egyptian culture they did everything in relationship to the moon and the sun. I mean, they were so, everything was auspicious.
Yep.
You must do this on this day when the moon is like this. And we were like, wow, you know.
Oh, yeah. Well, ancient cultures, even the Aztecs and the Mayans down in South America, they had the same thing. They knew exactly when to plant stuff, and they watched the moon and this and that and the other. I mean, it was all, even marriages and weddings, for God's sake, had to be.
Oh, really, absolutely.
Just craziness. But it works.
Chuck, this was awesome.
Well, I'm glad you had something fun to say and something to learn.
I just want to, you know, I want to thank you for spending your time with us, and we're going to be so excited to
to share your stories and your knowledge with
us. I trust it will be sufficiently edited.
Oh, yes. No, we're going to have every moment of us tasting grapes.
And now, a word from our sponsor. We like Happy Paste. We use it every day. And if we don't have Happy Paste, we turn around and say, Mom, get us some Happy Paste. We'll cry and scream and moan. So please, oh please, oh please, oh Mom, bring Happy Paste home.
Kids love the taste of Happy Paste, and moms love it too. A clinically proven cavity fighter with tartar control, Happy Paste also contains 10 milligrams of diazepam.
A suppressant used in the finest institutions.
In every squeeze of the tube. So moms will rave while kids behave while brushing daily with Happy Paste. Now available in mint, bubble gum, and for the older kids, single malt. 12 or 18-year-olds. So who likes Happy Paste?
Oh, please, oh, please, oh, please, oh, please, oh Mom.
Mommy?
Beat it, kid.
Our maiden voyage of episode from the road. This is our new series, and you got to hear, you know, it's that this was a highlight of Jewel of the Blue Ridge, was getting to know Chuck, getting to experience, you know, where we were through his eyes, through his history and expertise. But many other things happened on this property. We pulled in with this little teardrop trailer that we
rented
for this journey. Pulls, you know, it all starts pulling into the town of Marshall, right? And then being escorted by phone, right? We listened to Chuck as he guided us. Because GPS couldn't find property.
First, we interrupted a film shoot.
Oh, yeah, that was classic.
Yeah, you know, and it's just, and like the PA comes running over because we had to figure out how to get to this.
So the director was like, who are those people? Yeah. Get them out of my shot.
And she comes running over and she, I go, we're not staying here. I'm like, I go, we just need directions up the hill and, you know, we need cell service that's down here. She goes, well, you know, they're going to shoot and the director is going to be like, very upset. Know. And we're like, we're industry people. Like, he's okay.
It's like, just a movie, yeah. Which is never the thing to say to people that are making a movie because it's their entire life. And in that moment, you're like, hey, get out of my shot. So we then luckily get Chuck on the, you know, our cell phones, which become like a CB radio.
Yeah, but right? The best, so let's start back. So Ileana and I, like, we got ourselves a truck. And so we were like, you know, let's hit the road. We rented the teardrop. It was a 15-foot teardrop. We rented that from a couple in Asheville, North Carolina. So as we're getting to Marshall, North Carolina, it's these crazy switchback roads. And I haven't driven a trailer since like the early 90s when I used to landscape. So it's just like we threw ourselves into the fire, into this adventure, and we're taking these crazy roads, zipping around, and then we get up to this place.
And are guided to place the teardrop in a spot that is incredible. I mean, words can't even really describe it. I mean, just so you know what you just heard in that conversation with Chuck, we are surrounded by incredible mountain ranges and green rolling hills and animals, his incredible cows, and just, you know, amazing. And we're the only ones there. You know, we were the only ones parked there. We were allowed to through Harvest Host, you know, where they let you go into wineries and or agritourism, working farms, where you get to really not just be surrounded by other campers and RVers where you just feel like you're a bunch of people bumped up, but just you alone in the landscape.
Yeah, we had on the way back on our journey, we stayed at an alpaca farm one night.
That was really, really awesome to wake up in the morning and look out the window of the trailer and see, I don't know, like 100 alpacas.
I don't know if it was 100, but like it was a lot. You know?
It was a lot. In fact, I know for a fact, Mr. Know-It-All, that he had in his description of his alpaca mesa farm, it was like, we have like 500 alpacas.
All right.
So easy there, Tiger. But first cup of coffee, heading out, and then all eyes of alpacas on you, like, hey.
Yeah, and what's great is, like, when you jump out of your trailer in the morning, like, they look at you like, what are you doing here?
You're like, those were our companions. And, you know, the coolest thing I would say about hopping around from property and land to land and meeting was meeting all these different people, individuals, farmers, you know, artisans, musicians, travelers. To me, that's always been my favorite thing about traveling. It's not only meeting that you get to meet interesting people, but that you're just in a completely different frame of mind when you do meet them. You know, in our day-to-day life, we cross paths with other humans in really pedestrian ways or very antagonistic, frustrated ways, like everybody's tired of bumping into each other and dealing with each other's needs. But when you go out traveling, you have a different mindset. So when you cross paths with people, you may actually be bringing other things to the table, like, oh, I'm curious about you. I want to learn about your life. Your life looks different than mine. Instead of judging the fact that we seem different, I'm genuinely curious. Maybe that's just me. Maybe when other people travel, that's not the thing that does it for them. Well, but I love it.
Yeah, but, you know, when you meet everyone, it's in a fleeting moment, and then everyone's going on their way.
Yeah.
And I think, as, you know, since we are ex-New Yorkers, you know, we would go out into the world, we'd step out our door and be going into throngs of people.
Too much stimulus.
Yes, too much stimulus. And you know what? It's like everyone just kind of puts the head down, puts some headphones in, and minds their own business. And it's pretty incredible how it works that way.
But the opposite was when we would come onto a property, whether it was Chuck's property and Jeannie, his wonderful wife, who we met, and very lovely when we walked onto their property, when we were on the alpaca farm, when we went to that other farm in Tennessee. It was like interesting people, and there was the time and space and patience to just get to know people and see them in their environment.
Yeah, I mean, we had a fantastic time, and everyone we talked to was, like, super friendly, and there's cool RVs, and there are people out there had decked out transit fans, and, like, you know, you'd stop at a rest stop, and there'd be, like, a group gathered around as someone shared their vehicle.
Yeah,
like,
this culture of, you know, van life, RV life, you know, trailer life, it is mega. I mean, we already knew that before we hit the road, but it is amazing. There's a lot of creativity and innovation in this world, and James and I are definitely both excited to enter into it in our own way. We're going to come into it in our own way, whether it be the kind of rig we end up getting, the fact that we're doing the podcast, that we're bringing music and storytelling.
And we went and saw one of a past Know I Know podcast guest, Angela Shelton, who's been a friend of mine for 31 years.
You can listen to the episode Heart Baby.
Yes, she's a filmmaker. She's just an amazing person. She opened up a recording studio in
Nashville, Tennessee.
So we were rolling through, and we got to go to the ribbon cutting event and met, like, all the cool musicians.
Saw some really good country musicians, heard some great country music, yeah. And then, of course, we had to perform a couple songs of our own.
That's right.
That was a real hoot.
So, yeah, I mean, we're kind of streamlining our operation, and we're able to be mobile, and we want to go out into the world, and we want to collect stories from other communities and bring them back here.
Oh, yeah. So stay tuned for more episodes like this, more episodes from the road.
Yeah, so, you know, thanks again for listening, and check us out online at knowinowpodcast.com. That's knowinowpodcast.com.
And whatever platforms you do listen on, whether it's iTunes, Spotify, all that, please subscribe and rate and review us. That really does help us. We appreciate it.
Sure. We got the Know I Know Podcast YouTube channel, so there's some videos over there. You can always check out the nonprofit Stories Love Music.
That's right.
Ileana's been moving and grooving with that.
Well, I do appreciate that love. And I do want to say that if you would like to be a sponsor of the podcast, be a donor, someone that would make a donation so that we can continue to do these episodes for you. And also, if you have a suggestion of a great guest, a nonprofit we could spotlight, when you go to knowinowpodcast.com, there are ways to contact us about all of those things, and we would love to hear from you.
So, you know, thanks again for listening, and we're going to be off on a little mini adventure, right?
That is true.
gonna go see some family that I haven't seen in a long
time. You have family, James?
I do.
Do you come from somewhere?
Well, most people thought I was hatched from that ship that dropped me off.
I thought you were an alien for sure.
No more struggle, no more defiance, no loss of liberty, just a little compliance. If not for yourself, would you do it for me?